"Come on," called the magic moon in a dream-dipped voice so white. "There are other worlds than this." "No, stay," implored the sower seed, in bright blue soil entrenched. "We'll grow to our caprice." 1,000 angels likewise tempt, spirits drawn with pure intent, but each excluding others. Till an elder sprite, perhaps the very magic mother, subtlest of all I heard and saw, is the first to ever ask me, "Here's a pencil. Can you draw?"
Hey everyone, welcome back to Soul Scene. This is the final episode in our Mount Rushmore semester, and this week we are talking about Hayao Miyazaki. We are both going to do our very best to make this not a fanboy and fangirl episode, rather an episode where we wean lessons from his life, his work, and finally his characters.
Yeah, yesterday evening we were, I guess, doing a slight preparation conversation for this episode, but it's not that infrequently that we'll spend an afternoon talking about Studio Ghibli, and it very quickly devolved into one of us just saying the name of a film and the other one kind of swooning verbally or physically. So I would say, like, "And Ponyo?" And you'd be like, "I know." And so we think that would be quite a boring episode, but there'll be a touch of that. And hopefully, if you're a Studio Ghibli fan, you can relate, because I think it can be difficult to talk about these very endearing and beloved films without, you know, in a very articulate or kind of critical manner. But as well as the films of Studio Ghibli, today we're going to be talking about Hayao Miyazaki's life and, as Alicia said, taking some lessons, as we have done in every episode of this semester so far, starting with Shakespeare, ending with Miyazaki, the two most pivotal figures in human art history.
Absolutely. And we want to start by thanking everyone who has subscribed to us on YouTube. We don't have a ton of followers, but every one of you who have joined us on there, it makes us have a little moment of joy. It makes our day, makes our week sometimes. And so thank you.
Especially when you leave comments or emails. Those are really nice. Even if I hate comments, I still appreciate them. Alicia doesn't, but I'm a weird fan of them.
It's true. And also for anyone listening on the podcast apps, you may notice over the next few weeks, we take a small, small hiatus. After a couple years of posting every Monday, we're going to take a little break so that we can update the website, make more clothes, and make a Studio Ghibli zine that will be available on the website in a few weeks.
And there's a link in the description to that. So I think we can get started. We're talking about some lessons we can learn from his life. And I know that you have a very brief life story or some facts that you can perhaps share with us.
Yeah, I'll go through his early years because they were quite formative for his films. And perhaps as I go through and talk about these events, we can then talk about the films that were inspired by them.
Yeah.
So he was born in 1941 in Tokyo City, very urban area. His father was the director of Miyazaki Airplanes, which manufactured rudders for fighter planes during World War II. And this right off the bat is reflected in his work. He has quite the messaging surrounding anti-urbanization, I find, or not necessarily anti-urbanization, but he dreams of the rural life quite a lot.
Well, what I thought you were going to say was that in pretty much every film that Hayao Miyazaki's made, there's a very direct obsession with flights and planes.
Well, that was part two.
That's kind of the most obvious and I would say almost like signature motif.
Absolutely.
And so one of my first lessons from his life is maybe not the most universal, but I find it an inspiration for myself as a budding writer and artist, is being a jack of all trades or having a diverse kind of pool of imagery and stories that you like to tell is overrated. At least as a kind of advice that I hear given out almost as a blanket statement to artists. Because as you know, sometimes I feel a kind of doubt when I'm writing a story or writing a character or coming up with a plot point and thinking, I feel like I've already told this. This might be retreading another book that I wrote or another poem. But then I think there are probably dozens of frames within Miyazaki's films that I wouldn't be able to immediately tell you which one it's from, because they so often are the same skies with the same kind of whimsical flight going through them, which is not a bad thing. It just means that this is a story that you want to share.
And perfect.
Exactly.
We were discussing last night about his filmography and how The most obvious example is Nausicaa, which was his first film, Nausicaa, The Valley of the Wind, which was about anti-war and pro-environmentalism themes. And then a few years later, he remade that film, basically, in Princess Mononoke.
Well,
and
yeah.
It's very different. It's a different story, different visuals, but the same message. And people often say, I really liked Nausicaa, but Mononoke was just the better version of that. And we were even discussing how Spirited Away, which was the film that Hayao Miyazaki won his first Oscar for, that was almost perfected in The Boy and the Heron, which he just won his second Oscar for. And that parallel between those two latter films, we were discussing as we watched it in the theater. We said, this seems, there's an alleyway that the child goes through into this alternate reality. And it's less obvious than in the two environmental films.
Yeah.
But I think he wasn't afraid to perfect a story and to retell it, because they're important stories. And if you're passionate about it, people will enjoy watching you tell it multiple times from different perspectives with different language as you grow.
Yeah, I think The Boy and the Heron, I don't want this to turn into like a film analysis episode, but that was the first Studio Ghibli film that I felt had a slight self-awareness to it. It was a conscious kind of echoing of previous imagery, because I guess it was, fingers crossed it isn't, but it could be a last film, which
Absolutely.
Is a frequent trait, I think, of last films.
Yeah. The next stage of his life in terms of memories and impact were, at the age of 4, him and his family had to evacuate their hometown due to a bombing during World War II. And Miyazaki often talks about how some of his earliest memories are of bombed out cities, which is quite traumatic as a 3-year-old or 4-year-old, and you can see it reflected in a lot of his work.
Mm-hmm.
For example, The Boy and the Heron starts with this destructive fire ripping through his town of the main character, and then, of course, Grave of the Fireflies, another film which is riddled with this war imagery through the eyes of children. Although The Grave of the Fireflies was Isao Takahata's film, Miyazaki had a great impact on all of the stories told that came out of the studio, not just the ones that he directed. And between these early memories of bombings and apparently his father's personality, this is one thing that you and I wanted to talk about today, is how Miyazaki is quite the pessimist.
Yeah, I guess that's another kind of lesson too, is using negativity for good. At first, I was shocked when I started learning about the man behind these whimsical masterpieces, because I didn't watch these films growing up, neither did you. I only encountered them when I was like, I think I watched the first one when I was 17 or 18, and then have just kind of voraciously seen everything that we could, which is all of them. But then when you first start learning about Miyazaki and you think he's going to be like this kind of silly, fun Santa Claus character, which he most certainly isn't, and I love him all the more for that. I mean, we should, I guess, clarify, if it isn't obvious, that we don't know the man. So you kind of only have to go by what you see in videos and read in interviews, which, while there is quite an extensive catalog of this kind of reports, and it does cover decades, it's still obviously not fully representative of what the person is. But in any case, what you can glean from those is that such a grouch, such a like grumpy, negative, almost comically cynical old man, which I adore, because it means that you can make the most uplifting and pretty and childlike art out of, kind of fundamentally out of, dissatisfaction, is how I would characterize it.
Yeah, and we are both very inspired by this, as that is basically what we do every Monday on the podcast, is we see something in the world that we're dissatisfied with or think could be better, and then we talk about how to improve it without ever really mentioning even the thing that inspired that episode.
Hmm.
Sometimes we'll do a cursory mention of, oh, we saw this statistic or we saw this event happen.
Yeah.
But often we'll literally just jump right into imagining a beautiful, sustainable, tactile version of the future, which doesn't have that thing in it. And I feel like that's what he does.
I'm going to call it creative dissatisfaction. And the fact that also you can lean into not liking things. I often hear like that criticism, old man yells at cloud. Like if you or I, for instance, say something about social media or AI or whatever technology, or even like environmental degradation, it's like, oh, I'll get with the times.
Yeah.
But it's like, you don't have to. And there are some clouds that I think just deserve to be yelled at. But I think we're, so. There's this kind of overwhelming, like, well, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say it. But I love his kind of just blanket, yeah, critical statements. Like, there's the really infamous statement about how he doesn't like anime. Or there's a slight episode I'm going to reference later when he was shown a tech demo for a new kind of like procedural CGI that these developers showed him, and he was just really hilariously down on it. We're not going to mention, of course, his fraught relationship with his son, Goro. Look into that if you're curious. Yeah, it's a very simple, and it sounds like something very obvious, but even I sometimes struggle with it. You can be grouchy and less enthusiastic about things than other people around you. It doesn't make you, it doesn't make your soul any less pure, as you can see the in the works.
Absolutely. He often talks about his upbringing and his father, and basically said he had almost no relationship with his father because he was so busy with his work. And this obviously transitioned down to his own children and their relationship with him. But as you said, we won't get into that. But he said one thing that he did inherit from his father was his anachronistic feelings and his lack of concern about embracing contradictions. And I think a lack of concern about embracing contradictions is one thing that you and I really try to foster in ourselves and in our listeners, because of how all of our opinions are basically broadcast to everyone through social media. You have to be pretty black and white about things, or else things are open to misinterpretation. But our minds are able to embrace contradictions all at once. And this is reflected in so many of Miyazaki's works and his life. And, like, for example, during the Soviet Union era, he often would talk about how in his films there were these representations of communism in a good way, of communal ownership of factories and communal living. But he said he embraces the ideas of communism, but he completely rejects the Soviet Union's application of these ideas. Mm-hmm. And I think especially during that time when it was so politicized, and basically saying that would put you in this box, he was saying, no, you can be with both. You can see that something is good, but it's being poorly applied, or it's just not working here. And I thought that was a really interesting example, because I didn't fully know that about him, despite watching his films now through that lens. You see how he, during that time period, was representing these communist ideas while also denying the oppression of people and planet.
Yeah, I think you can have political sympathies as an artist, and it doesn't have to mean like a 100% ideological endorsement. And this is another kind of point I wanted to make, is the way that he speaks as an artist, retaining all that kind of creative integrity, but also, for one thing, he seems like he's full of self-doubt, which I greatly appreciate. There's clips of him working and he's often second-guessing him or saying like, oh, this is garbage, animation's such a hassle. But also, running through that, you can tell that there's a real sense of gut feeling and instincts, and that not everything is kind of rationalized. And I think that this often leads to what we would call messy screenplays, messy scripts, because we're used to everything being very cut and dry and kind of template, storyboarded. But even when it doesn't work, there's a kind of honesty running through it, which is just like, I mean, you said he embraced contradictions. I think sometimes he doesn't even know what this film is saying or what it's trying to say. He just knows that these images look right and they sound right and they feel right. And that's enough, kind of.
Yeah, with Nausicaa and the Valley of the Wind, one of his first films, once it came out, there were people praising him, saying, wow, you had this great, strong female character. This is such a feminist movie. And wow, this is so environmental and anti-war. Like, you were really putting yourself out there. And then his response to it was just, I don't think so. I was just trying to make something entertaining. So I think this was a lesson that I learned from him, and we often talk about as well, which is aesthetics and morals often being really, really strongly correlated. It's not 100%, but I feel like it's a 95% correlation between, if something's aesthetically good, then it will also be morally good. And that's so funny, because maybe it was intentional and he just was trying to play it cool.
Yeah.
But because of his personality, from what I've seen in interviews and stuff, it might not be him playing it cool. He might have just accidentally stumbled upon all of these strong female characters because he thought strong female characters are cool.
Yeah.
They look cool.
I think that's an interesting question. Obviously, this isn't about the feminism of Studio Ghibli. We might do that episode in a few weeks. That might be kind of fun.
Yeah.
But the question of like having so many heroines, do you think that was a deliberate, like that might give kind of an insight into his like creative process or how much this is thinking versus feeling. Do you think that's a deliberate kind of representation thing? I don't think so. I think it's just like in the world of Nausicaa is the hero that spawned from the imagination. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think so. Because I was hearing him talk about his filmography and until Spirited Away, which came out in 2001, mm-hmm. he in his head hadn't made a movie for little girls. He said Spirited Away, he wanted to finally make a film for little girls about crushes and exploring the world. But in my mind, all of his films had been for little girls, especially Kiki's Delivery Service.
Especially Porco Rosso.
Well, Porco Rosso might be the one exception. That's more for little boys and large men who like pigs flying planes.
Yeah, we watched this video on YouTube. There was someone ranking all the Studio Ghibli films and Porco Rosso was just dishonorably low. And the YouTuber said, like, who really has Porco as their number one? Who is going to bat for Porco? And that's me. Porco is my number one.
Yeah.
Maybe that's for another conversation or indeed just later in the episode
yeah.
when I really grab my pig-shaped soapbox.
Absolutely. A few more quick little facts about his life that I find informed his work was that his mother was suffering from spinal tuberculosis for a big chunk of his early years. She recovered and lived to the age of 73, which is remarkable, I'm not going to lie. But that image of either an absent mother or a sick mother or a sick loved one is present throughout a lot of his films. Mm-hmm. Sometimes his films are adaptations of existing stories, but in Totoro, for example, there's the really sick mother and the children are trying to get to her
yeah.
and dealing with that grief of like not a full loss, but in kids' eyes, it's quite a loss to have their mother be absent for so long.
Yeah.
And then the recovery and the joy when that happens. And another fun fact about his life is that he studied political economics in university. Because in my head, he either didn't go to university or if he did, it would have been for something arts related.
Mm-hmm.
But no, he just went for political economics, which is so funny to me to spend a chunk of your life doing that. But he had already developed an interest in manga drawing, but he thought he couldn't draw people. He could only draw tanks, planes, and like battleships.
He was that kid in the back of the class obsessively drawing like World War II guns. And
yeah,
stuff.
Exactly. Like that yeah. was him. He was so obsessed with planes and stuff. He could draw those, but he couldn't draw people. So he kind of dropped that dream for a little bit. But then once he graduated university, he maintained this relationship with his middle school art teacher, which is funny. Shout out to middle school art teachers
mm-hmm.
who was kind of mentoring him. And also while in uni, he was a part of the Children's Literature Research Club, which he said at oftentimes he was the only member of, but it was the closest thing to a manga club.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a part of that in university and started developing those skills a bit more.
I really like that university, just like obscure subject that he studied.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this has been maybe the number one theme running through our semester, starting with Sappho and Shakespeare. And we talked about Antoni Gaudi and now Miyazaki, all these different artists. And we've talked about this kind of dichotomy of art from studying versus art from living, meaning that expertise and inspiration can come both from Hemingway, we also mentioned he was a prime kind of subject that we were discussing this, can come from getting out and living and seeing things and studying just random stuff, like taking a course in like botany. And it can also come from, of course, immersing yourself in the craft and referencing the great works and really improving through study, reading, watching. I hate the word consuming, but just like immersing, surrounding yourselves with manga and anime. And I think part of the reason that his work is so different from so much other anime is that it's from observation of real life things and also participation in real life things. So I just wanted to say, live. Get out there. That's the kind of inspiration. Because even we were watching that video about his creative process, and he said that he'll go for drives with a camera attached to his car to film the surroundings so he can rewatch them mm-hmm. and see what kind of inspiration he can take image-wise and see what that might spark. It might be more fantastical, of course, but just like a particular angle or the way the light might hit it or like for me as a writer, I think I will read 10 books, but it roughly amounts to having one conversation in real life, because that one's authentic, that one's real. So
yeah, the quote that I saw from him on the subject was that a lot of anime and art in general today is made by humans who can't stand looking at other humans. And especially as such a pessimist, you'd think he would be one of those. He'd be among those people who can't stand looking at the world, but he chooses to look at the world and try and find the tiny, beautiful moments and extrapolate from that. And I think it's interesting because his filmography is relatively small. He's prolific in a way, but he also has only produced several of these masterpieces, but his idea notebooks are full of these things. And before he even opened the studio, he had countless screenplays, ideas for films. And some of them took 20, 30 years to actually make. He had the idea for Mononoke before he even opened the studio, and then it wasn't made for another 10 years. Like, it was a 30-year process, and he's just so patient with his ideas. He knows they're good.
Yeah, I think
that sticks with it.
That's maybe one of the biggest takeaways from his career, or maybe a career of any animator: patience, hard work, the really kind of trite advice that you give to creative people. Keep plugging away. I maybe disagree that he's not the most prolific. I think it's just the fact that the films take so long to make.
Yeah, that's true.
But in terms of always being working, it seems like even if it doesn't come out as a feature-length film, he's making like a tiny short or a doodle or the Nausicaa manga, or pre-film, he's working on television shows. Future Boy Conan, if people haven't seen that, is that, I think, one of the purest like Miyazaki visions for a world, and was a weird, always in the back of my mind when we're thinking about Solar Scene, even though it's like this post-apocalyptic with this crazy boy living on an island. There's something so idyllic about the way nature and simple living is presented in that series. Whenever you read the stat about the rates of animation that Studio Ghibli works at, where it's like, oh, it takes 6 years for one frame. Obviously, that's a hyperbole, but it's so impressive, the kind of, just patience and collaboration involved in making one of these, let alone like a dozen or 20. And obviously, this episode is kind of titled and mostly about Hayao Miyazaki, but it's not like it's a one-man job. I was saying yesterday, like, it's one thing for a painter to be holed away, you know, painting like Kiki's Delivery Service or coming up with these ideas, but it's another to be really shepherding a whole studio, like a whole team of people. And there's those more kind of leadership positions, but there's also the spirit of collaboration, which I think has kind of characterized a lot of his career, with co-founder Isao Takahata, who you mentioned did Grave of the Fireflies and many other masterpieces. We should do an episode about him also, because I think his films are really interesting for the variety that they possess, which Miyazaki's don't really. And also Joe Hisaishi and the other people who've composed scores for the films, which are just like mind-blowingly good.
Yeah.
and I think as much a part of the really widespread like affinity for Studio Ghibli as the images are is the songs.
Yeah, absolutely. I was so shocked to hear that Miyazaki just single-handedly found Joe Hisaishi and was like, oh, this great little minimalist piano player, composer, got him for his first film. And then obviously now he's done almost all of the scores for all the films. And it's like,
composes music outside of Ghibli as well. He's really very, very talented.
Recognizing talent is important, and going out on a limb and trying something new.
And I guess along these lines, another kind of lesson I wanted to pull is that an institution like Studio Ghibli feels like such an unattainable, just like monolith. But it was built by passionate artists.
Yeah.
So this is kind of a straightforward observation, but it's just that you can build things if you're not a marketer or entrepreneur.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? But also that building things doesn't have to be the goal, because I think when Miyazaki and Takahata were setting out just to tell their stories, they weren't like, we're going to build this massive worldwide beloved studio. It was just, I'm trying to get Nausicaa made.
Absolutely. And they had just such a purity of vision.
Yeah.
I was laughing out loud, as they say, at this interaction I read between Studio Ghibli and Disney. Because obviously for the first 20 years or so of this century, Disney was distributing the Studio Ghibli films in North America.
Mm-hmm.
But as we know, because neither of us saw any of them during our early years, it was a really poor job, and almost intentionally so, as to not be overshadowed.
Yeah, my very first exposure to Studio Ghibli was seeing the Ponyo commercials on Disney Channel, circa 2009 or 2010, whenever that came out, and being like, what is this? Why is Miley Cyrus in this?
But something funny, this funny story that I read about was Suzuki, who is the money behind Studio Ghibli, he's one of the execs, I suppose,
mm-hmm.
was in talks with Harvey Weinstein, of all people, from Disney at the time. And he was saying, no, we need to cut down Nausicaa. We can't, like, they're not going to like it in North America. It's too
weird.
Too weird. It's too intense. Like, they won't like it. And then apparently Suzuki sent a samurai sword with just a note that said, no cuts. And there were no cuts made, and people loved it. They were obsessed with it, because what Miyazaki says is the difference, the biggest difference between Studio Ghibli and Disney, is that Studio Ghibli treats their viewers as competent.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that Disney shows nothing but contempt for the audience. And I kind of feel like it's true. Even their earliest films, it's treating everyone like children, treating even children as lesser than their full potential. Making everything so simple and so silly and funny. But Miyazaki was saying kids can listen to these big concepts because they experience these big feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't need to just put in these kind of weird, like, backhanded jokes that the adults laugh at the way that Disney and Pixar do. They're like, oh, let's put in a joke about farts and, like, things that adults will find funny. But Ghibli does it in, like, the opposite way. They're like, let's put in these heavier topics that kids might not pick up on.
Mm-hmm.
They might just see a cat riding around on a broomstick with a girl who looks like a witch, and, like, that's fun for them. But they also might see the struggling, like, business owners and empathize with that.
Well, I think Disney, particularly early Disney, leans much more into fairy tale. And I don't know if this is a, like, Western versus Japanese conception of what that term even means, but I don't mind the simplicity of, like, Sleeping Beauty and Cinderella and Snow White. They're not real worlds like the Ghibli kind of heroines are. I mean, the keys in the word, the princesses versus, like, the normal people, mostly in the Studio Ghibli films. Claude from Elemental, Pixar, shout out him. Could he appear in a Studio Ghibli film?
I feel like Claude could be a Studio Ghibli character.
I think so.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Similar to Calcifer. But I think the second major difference between those two is that Miyazaki has such a strong ethos of do not copy. Apparently a lot of his early work, he destroyed himself, even as a kid, because he had this realization that he was copying other people's styles,
mm-hmm.
and he wanted to create his own. And I think Disney created his own style. It's quite iconic, but all of the stories were fairy tales that already existed. And I feel like even when Miyazaki tried to do fairy tales like Ponyo, he was inspired by The Little Mermaid, it just turned into some weird, like, he can't help himself from being creative. And I think it's a slight difference between, as you and I call them, the new kid eyes versus the old kid eyes. And it's like, nowadays we're looking at our phones so much, it's like we can't have ideas.
Yeah, this is a good introduction into the villain of the week.
Yeah.
Do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Villain of the week. And it is generative AI, which I don't want to talk about at length because it's such a positive kind of celebration of an episode. And the villain of the week is more just like remember those guys? Let's not do that. The aforementioned clip of Miyazaki reacting to the CGI is what inspired this pick, as well as just reading some things about particular films which have been using this technology. And I had a quote from him in response to it, which was his reaction to that tech demo. This might be a bit of a weird segment if you haven't seen it, but there's like a 2-minute clip on YouTube. You can watch it if you want. Basically, these really excited young animators showed him this demo of, like, bodies falling around and writhing, which was kind of using a new procedural animation software. And they were hoping that he would be really happy about it, but he was indeed not happy and didn't hesitate to say, "I feel strongly that this is an insult to life itself." And so what I really love is that just like visceral, as mentioned before, the artist's gut feeling or that kind of aesthetic indignation about something where you don't necessarily need to have a rational, like, this is an insult to life itself because ABC, you can just say, "I feel this." And it maybe this sounds like a bit of an anti-intellectual thing. It's not like I'm against rational thought or something, but I just think the gut has been so removed from the way that we're kind of conditioned to traverse the world today. And Miyazaki is a good example of being guided by it.
I think as an artist, being so in tune with yourself and your feelings that even if you say something that seems bold, you could eventually rationalize it.
Yeah.
But you're just in tune with, you're able to name things. You're able to name the emotions, name the thoughts.
Yeah.
In a way that often when I see something.
Or draw them.
Yeah. I start saying, "Oh, I think this might be sort of, it has this sort of vibe," and then you're meandering. You can't just name the feeling that it evokes. And that's the difference between a master and a and a me.
But I think, don't be so hard on yourself. Your clothes are good. They're behind you. I think when you watch Totoro or Ponyo, that same positive feeling that you have, which you don't always need to say, "I love this because," you can just have that initial, "This sits well with me."
Yeah.
I think we can also have that X doesn't sit well with me. And that's how I feel about generative AI. And that will be the cloud which I forever yell at until I am an old man.
Yes.
So that's how that goes. And now we're going to start talking about some lessons from the films in particular, which we think we can take for our lives and those of the imagined inhabitants of our imagined beautiful, sustainable, tactile, imagined utopia, the solar scene. And the first one for me is the empty, quiet moments, which in Japanese, I think is called ma, M-A. And the most famous example of this in the Studio Ghibli films is the train ride in Spirited Away, where it's kind of quiet for a while and you're just sitting there with Chihiro, and it's more about the vibes than anything actually happening. But I think also, not to keep referencing it, but in Porco Rosso, there's many shots of planes in the sky where the sound just cuts out entirely. And even the soundtracks themselves tend to be quite minimal, and there'll be breaks between different notes, which, yeah, just let you sit with things, and there's like breathing room, which I think a lot of, I would say Western films, but just a lot of films, period, don't allow.
Yeah, and Miyazaki has said he doesn't want anyone to ever be bored in his films, but he knows that we won't, he treats us as competent and intelligent, he knows we won't be bored, that we like a little moment to be in the world. And I always think because they're hand animated, the amount of time it took to make this quiet moment is insane. It took probably 6 months to make this moment, but they still trust us with it and trust that it's valuable, and we want these little respites.
Yeah. Do you have a moment of ma from the films that you think of that comes to mind that you really appreciate or makes you love the film more?
As much as you and I don't like The Secret World of Arrietty, the little moments when the people are doing their tiny tasks.
Yeah.
So they're collecting leaves to use as umbrellas or crumbs to have as this feast for dinner. Building, I find, like, that funny.
Building these intricate pulley systems just to grab a can or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's another point about the beauty of the mundane, which I think is also widely celebrated most often in the food. You know, there's so many kind of lovingly animated sequences of the ramen in Ponyo or all the food in Spirited Away. I think it's all through that, or Totoro. I guess people like that it makes their life feel artful and special because cooking is something that we all do and eating is something that we all do. But I think there's an extra level to this, which is it's not just celebrating the beauty inherent in mundane tasks like that. It's also tying it to kind of world changing significance. I think about The Boy and the Heron, which came out last year, which I think reconciles these two sides of the stories really well, where at the end, the old man... Is it a spoiler? Should I spoil it? I'll just say there's a big theme about how you live is kind of how the world will take shape. I like the quotes, the world is like a bicycle, it goes where our eyes go. So if you're doing things in a certain way and looking upon all that you observe with certain eyes, then, you know, that will kind of tweak our direction as a species. Well, Howl's Moving Castle is another really good example of that, where Sophie basically just comes in and cleans the castle,
yeah,
which is something anyone can do, but it's presented as this like life-altering moment for Howl. He's like, Sophie, you saved me through making bacon and eggs and cleaning his messy house.
Yeah. A theme in all of his movies is the way he depicts good and evil. I was reflecting on this and realized it's quite a Buddhist representation of the roots of evil and good.
Mm-hmm.
And he never pits these irredeemable characters against the heroines. He always has us sympathize with the bad guys and says, okay, it makes sense that they're doing this. Mononoke comes to mind because the evil woman in that is running this arms factory, basically, yeah, to enable this war. But she also, the reason she was doing it was to provide a job for these women with leprosy.
Yeah.
And so that's a highly sympathetic character. And like, it'd be scary to do that because you don't want it to get muddled and then accidentally promote arms or promote war. But it was very clear as the viewer that he's not promoting the production of missiles.
Yeah.
But also that you feel bad for the person.
Yeah, I think another kind of slight example is in Porco Rosso, the American guy Curtis. He's maybe about as clear-cut a villain as you'll see in one of these movies, in that he's, yeah, just an antagonist. But he's also probably the most lovable character and the funniest character, and it's, yeah, not like the audience really detests him, or even the other characters. They kind of treat him as just like this funny, puffed-up like American annoyance. But he's, yeah, it's those contradictions that you were talking about earlier. Yeah. And also regarding nothing irredeemable, I think this is symbolized in the architecture of the films, so much of which is grandiose and impressive and really embodying the majesty of the world, often kind of mirroring the personality of its makers or its inhabitants, often kind of passageways into a magical world, or representing said magical world like the bathhouse in Spirited.
Yeah.
In Spirited Away, but also regarding the like irredeemability of it, there are a weird amount of cleaning sequences where the Howl's Moving Castle is just a mess on the inside, and Sophie manages to clean it, and in doing so, kind of cleans the lives of its inhabitants. Or I know it's not a Hayao Miyazaki film, but in his Sons from Up on Poppy Hill, there's the school clubhouse, which we adore, that sequence where they kind of just scrub it inside out and,
yeah,
save it in that way. And in The Boy and the Heron also, and yeah, just like the outside and the inner world, the soul aligning, something along those lines.
Yeah, like as I was saying with the Buddhist philosophy, it's the evil is always rooted in greed, ill will, and delusion, and it's transformed into loving kindness, mm-hmm, wisdom, and generosity. And the transformation is really depicted through these spaces. And I like that it's not just so black and white as evil. They're killing and they're doing bad things, and then they have to completely change and then be doing good things. It's more the root of the actions is changed, and then it appears differently.
Do you have a location from any of the films that you would most like to visit? I know it's a tough question, but for me, I think it's called Gina's Place in Porco Rosso.
Yeah.
The hotel where everyone flies in. She's singing. It's a soulful place. And the whole setting.
A few ideas I have. The Toxic Jungle.
You want to visit the Toxic Jungle?
Well, just the way that Nausicaa talks about it is as if it's the most beautiful thing in the world.
Well, it is. I mean, that's a really great example also of the outside world and the soul and how maybe all is not what it seems kind of thing.
Yeah.
Also, maybe I'll amend my answer to just every location in Kiki's Delivery Service. Something I really, really find fascinating and artistically inspiring about Studio Ghibli's films is this kind of non-existent condensation of Europe, which often appears in different guises. And Kiki's Delivery Service is a good example where it feels the most familiar of any of the settings, but it doesn't exist. Like, it's not a real country. It's not quite Germany. It's not quite, I think they were inspired by a town called Visby in Sweden, but it just takes from all these different places. And even the script in it is a little bit like regular script, but also it has this kind of like Germanic weirdness to it. And so yeah, maybe I'll just say every place in Kiki's Delivery Service, which also prompts me to ask the question, similar to the villain of the week being generative AI, do you think that Miyazaki, through his works, can be read as a Luddite? Do you think he is fundamentally kind of hesitant about new technologies?
I think so. Because even the new technologies that he depicts, like Howl's Moving Castle, is quite steampunk. It's grassroots. It's never top-down. Whenever there is a top-down technology like the dirigible or weapons, those are always depicted as evil.
The more I watch Kiki's Delivery Service, the more I really think that theme is at the core of the film, about like modernity versus old-fashioned or traditional devices. Because the film opens obviously with her listening to a radio, but also all the way through, as you mentioned, there's a dirigible, and it's kind of contrasted with her flight, and the way that she saves the day at the end is by using just an old janitor's broom, which isn't even supposed to be like a broomstick, kind of. There's Tombo with his propeller bike that he's desperately trying to build. But I think, for instance, that bike is presented positively.
Yeah.
Whereas the blimp and the kind of unthinking, maybe it's more the unthinking allegiance that people might have to said new technologies that he's often denouncing. Or the different ways that airplanes are viewed, sometimes as just like these harbingers of destruction and evil. Or in Porco Rosso, which I think is kind of fundamentally a movie about building things, which I always love, just like this really amazing craft, which it is, or can be, should I say.
This one-of-a-kind plane that he's obsessed with fixing. He refuses to get a new plane because he knows that this one plane is the best. And people always refer him to say, no, you can't fly this. It's aerodynamically impossible. And he's like, no, but I know how. Mm-hmm. And so it's not against technology, but I think it is against the blind acceptance of technology, or the blind belief that things can only get better. Because some things are good as they are.
Another lesson to take from the films, touch grass. This is in every single film, but the example I wanted to pull was not grass, but water in the opening of Ponyo. The underwater imagery at the start of that film is so kind of like tactile and wondrous, and reminds me of the way that I used to see nature as a kid, which is like being childlike, but also actually that's still how I see sea life now and fossils, in this kind of, it doesn't look real, like they all look like they were just drawn, which is what makes it so magical. But I really love this kind of, it's almost like a bit of a negative feedback with the Ghibli films, where I never feel the urge to binge them, really. Right? It's like you see one, and then it's, rather than sitting down and watching it again or watching many others, for me at least, it makes you just want to go outside and properly experience life.
It's true. There's very few films that do that for me, but all of the Ghibli ones do that for me. And they make me want to interact with people differently, create. I mean, my favorite Ghibli film is Whisper of the Heart.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, the characters, one of them's really into making violins, one of them's really into writing, and I don't want to make violins or write, but it makes me want to do something with all of my being, and that's something that Miyazaki has done.
Yeah, you do like Country Roads, though.
I do like Country Roads.
You do want to sing that with all your might.
Of course. And it's so funny to hear him talk about it, about his craft, because his wife was also an animator. Mm. But then when they had kids, they took a step back. They both wanted to keep animating, but then this is why we never fully endorse the people we talk about. He was basically like, well, I'm going back to work. And the wife ended up having to stay at home. And his kids often talked about how he was pretty much absent, and the only way they could relate to him was through his art.
Yeah.
And now that he's even 83, he still chooses to work and start a new film, even though everyone around him is like, please take a break. He can't imagine not working and sees that as boring.
Yeah. Okay, two more notes I wanted to take. Both are pertaining to emotions. One is about being childlike, not childish, because I think this is a binary kind of misunderstood or forced on us regarding like hashtag adulting in the modern world, where it's like, oh, you want to be childlike means like just being silly or being immature or absolving yourself of responsibility. But I love the way that through like dozens of characters, Studio Ghibli's films depict the fact that you can stay a child while taking on adult responsibilities and even like becoming quite an aged person. Like, I think it's actually most evident in a lot of the way that elderly people are kind of lovingly presented in Studio Ghibli, which is often having a kind of sense of mischief or like winking at a child because they know about the soot sprites, or they're just like, generally speaking, through wisdom, coming to realize the inherent worth of like joy and fun, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
Basically, it means you don't have to be humorless or whimsyless, but it also means you don't have to be kind of self-consciously quirky, which no one really likes that. Another example is the older girl, the older sister from My Neighbor Totoro. She's probably one of my favorite characters of the whole studio's filmography because she is obviously the more mature one compared to Mei. I think her name's Satsuki, but she's still a child and she'll still like laugh with Totoro and like run around. And I think that so often, if you're the older child or if you're kind of reaching adolescence or in your like 20s, yeah, you feel that you have to feign a kind of solemnity, should I say. But she's like still rolling around on the grass, basically.
Yeah.
And then secondly and finally, it's that I think the films tell us that the worst emotion is no emotion. Many of the protagonists face moments of failure, embarrassment. They will cry and they will keep trying anyway. So I guess another way of saying this is about courage and bravery, which seem almost like old-fashioned or kind of too serious words for what we do in the world today. But I think it's best embodied through Kiki and Kiki's Delivery Service, where it's like, basically the film is just about her moving to a new town. But the fact that is she 12 or 11?
Yeah.
Or 13? Makes it seem like such an undertaking, which it is even for an adult. And it's not ridiculous to say like, oh, I have to be brave today. I have to have courage. Like, that shouldn't be just reserved for Lord of the Rings. It's like, you have to have courage to make your first delivery also. And that's how you grow. Another example is Chihiro, obviously, in Spirited Away, where it's like this place that she finds herself in is just terrifying.
Yeah. And I feel like a lot of stories, when they depict bravery and courage, it's in a stoic way. You never see them cry or be afraid or shake or try and give up. It's literally just, I see this scary thing and I'm going to be brave. But with this, like, they see the scary thing, they cry or they try and run away, but then they are encouraged by people around them or by their environment to then conquer it.
That's why I like the melancholy that Kiki falls into. It's such a rare, like, to see an accurate depiction of just kind of malaise, especially in a kid's film, is so rare.
It's true.
And it's not even this like massive dramatic like, oh, and the skies fell dark thing. It's just like, she's a young teenager or a tween, and that's a spell that everybody goes through but is never told in stories.
Absolutely.
So, actually, I do have two other final things, just because I said I would close by talking about some of the characters, but we've already covered quite a few of the ones I wanted to mention. Totoro. Firstly, what do you think he feels like?
I feel him as slightly bristly, almost like a bristly dog.
Yeah. Secondly, did you ever have an imaginary friend?
I didn't. No. I was always around a lot of kids, so never had the time to imagine another one. It would be kind of weird if I was around a bunch of kids and was like, well, here's Philippa.
Yeah. I think I was similar in that by the time I needed an imaginary friend, I was a little bit too old to have an imaginary friend, which is maybe not a unique experience, but still a sad one. And then finally, I think we should close the episode, the whole semester indeed, by talking about Calcifer, who, if you're not a Ghibli head, is a sentient flame Lump of Fire, really.
Yeah.
Who is in Howl's Moving Castle, and who I think presents one of the most kind of enduring and endearing visual gags in any film ever, when he really greedily eats up the eggshells that he's tossed after the rest of the gang have breakfast.
Yeah, so he is the fire in charge of keeping the castle moving. It's a fire-powered vessel. And so he's always complaining about how he has to work so hard. And basically the wizard in this movie, like, Calcifer was a real person, but then sentenced him to be in charge of all of this. And so he becomes a flame and he can't move without, if you put him in like a little pile of coals, you can move him around.
Yeah, he's a play on the kind of disgruntled witch's familiar trope, which I always love in fiction.
Yeah.
But does he remind you of any of the other people or goddesses mentioned during this semester? I thought it would be a good way of bringing it full circle.
Yeah. I mean, he's absolutely the male fictional version of Hestia, who was the goddess of the hearth, who was in charge of warming the home. So she was motherly, but also, obviously, fire is destructive, and so Hestia could be destructive. And same with Calcifer. When he'd get angry, he could, like, scorch everything in the room. Yeah. But also, he'd get kind of sad when the fire would go out. And at the end, they move him into a different vessel. And it's kind of like, even though the castle is destroyed or reworked, the heart of the fire is moved. And that's the same as Hestia. When people would move in ancient Greece, they would move some ashes from one place to the next.
I was going to give you a quiz for the whole semester, but I feel like that proves that you have been paying attention.
Thank you.
I guess anecdotally, because we've been talking about people for the last 12 weeks, and some of whom I knew quite well, like Shakespeare, or knew of quite well, and some of whom I had no idea whatsoever, like Marie Kondo, we talked about last week, I think I've retained a lot more from each episode and our research and our discussions than I have from previous topics we've covered, like, for instance, education, where we learn about different educational systems, which I'm not going to say I learned nothing, because it was still informative and I still, you know, you come away with different opinions and knowing more. But I think these kind of factoids being tied to that, I guess that's just human nature, that you pay more attention when it's a person that you're learning about.
It's true. So thank you all for joining us on this journey. We're going to be doing a little mini semester in a few weeks, so stay tuned for that. And it is going to be related to today's episode. If you can make any guesses, let us know what you think it's going to be about.
Salut!